Sunday evening here in Stockholm, time for the Environment and Sustainability Radio Show, Think Globally Radio, heard at this time, 7 o'clock every Sunday evening. My name is Eric Paglia. I'm alone here in the studio this evening. Richard Bloom can't make it, Dave Truva unavailable, but tonight's episode is actually going to be a pre-recorded interview that I did just a few days ago with a highly distinguished professor from the University of Waterloo in Canada, who is visiting Stockholm for a workshop over at the Resilience Center, and had a chance to sit down and talk with me about a lot of his current thinking, his research, and other observations he's made over the past few years and through the course of a long and distinguished career researching environment, security, global crisis, societal crisis, and a lot of the challenges facing humanity in the decades to come. Professor Thomas Homer Dixon, actually kind of a big name in environmental circles. He'll be the guest on tonight's episode of Think Globally Radio, where, like I said, it's a pre-recorded interview. I sat down with him over at his hotel a few days ago, and he really opened up, talked about a lot of his current thinking that you can now listen to. It's 1 hour straight, almost 1 hour, so there'll be no music or anything, just Professor Homer Dixon and myself chatting, him doing most of the talking, of course, on a wide variety of subjects. We're going to be bringing up everything from global governance to various issues around climate change, some of his thoughts on that, and specifically also about geoengineering, something that he's written about. He actually writes quite a bit of popular science. He writes a column for the New York Times from time to time, Washington Post, the Toronto Globe and Mail, Financial Times. So he's really an academic and a thinker that really gets out there to try to influence the discourse on these various subjects, which he is an expert on. Of course, his original rise to international prominence came from his research on environment and security and linking environmental degradation with violent conflict. He's written such books as Environment, Scarcity, and Violence, and The Ingenuity Gap, and most recently, a few years ago, The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. So Thomas Homer Dixon, the renowned scholar from the University of Waterloo in Canada, on tonight's episode of Think Globally Radio, which is heard every Sunday evening, and on the internet at www.thinkgloballyradio.org. My name's Eric Paglia here in the studio, and I now turn things over to Professor Thomas Homer Dixon on tonight's episode of Think Globally Radio. Your last major popular science book was published in 2006, and it was probably written in the years prior to that, and much has happened since then, since the publication of The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. So how have these tumultuous events in the past 5 years, the financial crisis, the events leading up to Copenhagen, COP15, and all the disappointment that has come since then, how has this affected your thinking in terms of some of the ideas you brought up in your book?
I haven't really had reason to change the underlying analysis or theory. It took me about 20 years to develop that perspective. It's draws on a lot of different people and a lot of different sources. And I think it serves really well. And people who've looked at the book closely are sometimes surprised how prescient it is. For instance, there's a long discussion in the book about the nature of contemporary capitalism and why it's vulnerable to crisis. And then there's some discussion of vulnerabilities in the future and what might happen, including a mention of the possibility of a collapse in the housing market in the United States and what that might mean for the global economy. So, I mean, to be frank, without tooting my horn too much, and I think in some cases the book really nailed it. But that's a function as much as anything else of a well-developed background theory of how complex systems develop, how they progress over time, how they become more vulnerable to crisis. And I'd have no particular reason to change that background theory. I think what I've seen in the world in the intervening 5 or 6 years since I was writing that book simply in many ways goes to reinforce or provide more evidence for the general analysis I provide. And in some of my most recent writing, I've continued to return to the idea that's the central thesis in the book, which is that change in human societies will be punctuated. It's going to be marked by crisis. And that what we need to do is be preparing to take advantage of those crises rather than hoping that we can somehow manage our way incrementally through the challenges that face us.
Okay, how do we exploit these crises situations for improving our resilience? Another concept that you return to often in your various writings.
Well, the idea of exploiting crisis is very closely associated with the idea of resilience. In some ways, being able to take advantage of crisis effectively is part of having a resilient system or resilient society. But in other ways, and I think this is in some ways a more profound point, what you want to be sure is the case is that your society or your social system, your economy, or whatever system you're talking about, doesn't collapse when it's hit by a shock, when it's hit by a crisis. In other words, you want the system to be resilient enough that it stays functioning so that you can take advantage of the crisis. If for instance, you have a society with a extremely vulnerable food system and there's a drought or a pathogen affects that food system and all of a sudden you have a major food shortfall, and as a result, the whole society falls apart. You have violence and civil war. Then you're not able to take advantage of that crisis to reform your food system. If, on the other hand, the society takes the food hit but is able to step back and say, okay, what did we learn from this? How can we change things for the better? And marshal its resources and make the reforms necessary, then that's a resilient society. So resilience provides kind of a baseline foundation capacity for response in a situation of crisis. And it's the first thing you have to do. And I emphasize that in my book, that what we need to do is increase the resilience of our society so that we're better prepared to take advantage of crisis, to use those opportunities to produce deep reform in our economies and societies, food systems, technological systems, what have you.
You've argued elsewhere that modern society is not so resilient. We're maybe almost overly efficient, or we have some sort of deficit of resilience. And a couple of concepts you bring up that aren't obviously problematic, but you argue that they are, is the complexity of modern society and also the connectivity of modern society. Could you perhaps expand upon that, please?
Well, complexity and connectivity are closely related to resilience, and there's a long story there. And one of the problems we face when we talk about complexity and connectivity is that we actually have a very underdeveloped vocabulary. Our analytical system, even at the level of scholarship, even at the level of the best research in these areas, we don't really do a good job of discriminating between different kinds of complexity or discriminating between different kinds of connectivity. And we need to do that. Because what I've been realizing as I've been reading the literature and thinking about this a lot is that, to be simplistic about it, some kinds of connectivity are good and some kinds are bad. Some kinds of complexity are good and some kinds are bad. And we need to be better able to understand which is what, where, and when. And it gets even more complicated than this. Some kinds of connectivity might be good in certain kinds of circumstances, but bad in other kinds of circumstances. So inevitably, there's always a kind of a relational property involved. You can take a particular form of complexity or connectivity and put it in different circumstances, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing changes. So we have a huge need for research here because our vocabulary and our concepts are not adequately developed for having this conversation. Be that as it may, I think we can say that overall, speaking in very general terms, the systems that human beings have created, especially in the most economically developed societies in the world, are too complex and too connected to be adequately resilient in the way that I discussed a few minutes ago, so that they've become brittle. And it's become more likely that if they're hit by a crisis or shock, that you get catastrophic failure that doesn't allow for an adequate response to crisis, a creative response to crisis. And that's bad. So we have a financial system in the world, for instance, as we've seen in the last few years, that when, you know, a relatively minor component of that financial system, the housing market, in fact, a component of that component, the subprime mortgage housing market in the United States, runs into crisis, it not only takes out that component of the system, but affects the entire system. So economies on the other side of the planet find that they are directly impacted, that there's a kind of cascading failure that extends as far away as the other side of the planet. And we found that for the first time since the Great Depression, every single major economy in the world went into a simultaneous economic nosedive. Now, that's not a resilient system. It's one that is too connected in the wrong ways and too complex in the wrong ways. It's too complex in that it has become almost entirely opaque to a lot of people who are trying to manage it or cope with its behavior. They can't understand what's going on. You know, the time and time again, we heard from the most senior economic managers in the world that they didn't know what was happening, that they didn't understand a lot of the financial instruments that had been developed and their consequences, collateralized debt obligations, the structured investment vehicles, the credit default swaps. A lot of this vocabulary wasn't even available to the most senior managers in the world. Some of them had to have special seminars from highly specialized financial innovators and investors to tell them what was going on. Well, here's a system that in many respects is I think, very dangerous to all of us. And it's not just in the world financial system. You see the same kind of phenomena developing in many other central systems that are vital to human survival and well-being, communication systems, food systems, energy systems, and the like.
One part of our everyday vocabulary that is often two words that are used sometimes interchangeably, but you make a point of distinguishing them, is risk and uncertainty. Can you perhaps explain what the difference is and how it pertains to this brittleness in systems?
The distinction between risk and uncertainty is one that has been made for about 80 years or so, going back to work and ideas that were developed by a leading economist by the name of Knight in the 1920s in the United States. So this is often called the Knightian distinction between risk and uncertainty. And very basically, in a world of risk, you have sufficient information on which to base judgments about the probable costs and benefits of making various choices. So you have sufficient data or information that allows you to decide with whatever system you're working with, let's say it's an economic system, that it's likely to develop along certain pathways and what the probability associated is with each of those pathways is, and then what the likely costs and benefits of developing along a particular pathway are. In a world of uncertainty, you don't have sufficient evidence to make any such judgments. You're in a situation, as it's famously been called, of unknown unknowns. You don't even know what questions to ask. You're ignorant of your own ignorance. And this is a fundamentally different situation. It's one that is quite well understood by people who have been in military combat. In fact, if you look at some of the greatest works on combat and fighting, military engagements, for instance, Karl von Clausewitz's famous treatise on war, which was published in the 19th century, von Clausewitz talks about friction on the battlefield, talks about the fog of war. Military people have a deep understanding that stuff happens, that surprises come out of the blue. And somehow many of our social managers, many of the managers of our technical systems have forgotten that lesson. They think that they can understand the systems they're working with so well that they can manage them very precisely. But what we've actually been doing as our societies and those technical systems have been developing very rapidly in recent decades is they've been becoming more replete with unknown unknowns. We've been getting a situation of even greater uncertainty. So managers have found themselves increasingly out of their depth. increasingly incapable of understanding what's going on in these systems. They've been enveloped by a world of uncertainty, but they're still using the tools of risk management. And we can see the consequences with something like this recent economic crisis. The suggestion then is that we either need to change the systems very fundamentally and return them to a more manageable characteristic, or we need to just accept that there's a lot we can't understand, and we need to be much more prudent in our principles of interaction with these systems and need to not be surprised by surprise and assume that things will happen that we don't expect and be more prepared in a nimble and flexible way to cope with them. I would opt for the latter option rather than the former. I don't think we're going to be able to return systems to a kind of a form that decomplexifies them and makes them manageable in the precise way that we've thought we could manage them before.
How would you apply this this risk-uncertainty dichotomy to perhaps the most complicated or complex systems, the climate system? And would you call the climate change debate right now, or climate change as such, a crisis?
There's absolutely no question that it's a crisis, but it's a crisis of an unusual form because it kind of unfolds over a long period of time. I think the conventional understanding of crisis is that it's a punctuated event, and certainly the way I've been using it in our conversation up to this point has been in those terms. That a punctuated event occurs in a short period of time, and it produces an opportunity for punctuated change, either good or bad, in whatever system you're talking about. I don't think there's any doubt that our crisis in climate will produce, on occasion, punctuated change. In other words, there will be climate events that have major short-term impacts, perhaps on our food production, perhaps producing societal failures might be happening, for instance, in Pakistan right now. But for the most part, climate is an unfolding long-term stressor. It's a crisis that in geological time might happen in a very short period of time over a period of centuries, but for human societies, that's a long period of time. And for a whole bunch of reasons, we're not well adapted or well adjusted cognitively, biologically, ecologically, socially, politically, economically, to coping with such a crisis that unfolds over long periods of time. It's almost kind of the classic wicked problem. It has all the characteristics of a problem that human beings would be, you know, in advance, if we thought about it in advance, if we were to choose a problem that we would be really, really bad at dealing with. Climate change has all those characteristics. And sure enough, we're not even beginning to cope with the challenge it presents. The climate system is a highly complex system. It has the capability of responding sharply and suddenly on occasions in a nonlinear way, of flipping from one state to another state in ways that we couldn't expect. So it's full of those unknown unknowns. It is fundamentally an uncertain system. You know, scientists have done a very good job, atmospheric scientists, of trying to understand what's going on in the climate, but they really, by their own admission, have only really scratched the surface. There are countless things that they don't adequately understand, some of which may be very, very important for anticipating what's going to happen in the future. The climate system has very long lags in its response to perturbations. So you change radiative forcing or the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, and you don't see the full consequences of that sometimes for centuries or more after the initial change. So there's, from a social perspective, there's an enormous scope for procrastination. Well, we don't have to worry about it because we aren't going to see these consequences for a long period of time. So the combination of that a long time lag characteristic, what climate scientists call inertia and uncertainty, makes it very difficult for us to cope with climate.
And then politically, you mean?
Politically and socially. Mm-hmm. And then there are other characteristics too. The factors that are contributing to climate change relate to our energy systems. In fact, the central the central source of energy for our modern civilization, fossil fuel, is implicated in climate change. What this means is that if we're going to deal with the climate change problem, we have to essentially revolutionize our energy production system around the whole planet. Now, fossil fuels provide 80% of the energy in our economies. Oil provides 98%, 99% of our transportation energy. We don't have a clearly developed plan B. Whatever we do is going to be very disruptive, and it's going to cost some groups an enormous amount. Those groups are very powerful because they play a central role in our economies. And they are, of course, quite understandably using all the resources at their disposal to try to convince us there's not a problem. So we have a combination here of characteristics that makes the problem of climate change deeply intractable. And you add on top of that the fact that we've got 190 countries involved. This is what social scientists would call a collective action problem, but it's among the most difficult collective action problems that you could possibly imagine. No one of those countries has an incentive to move first because they will bear all the cost, whereas everybody else shares all the benefit of any action that they take. To try to coordinate all of these different actors simultaneously to move together to benefit themselves all together is an enormous political and social challenge, and almost an unimaginably difficult one. So here we are with a complex system that is deeply entangled, climate system, deeply entangled with another complex system, our energy system, neither of which we really understand adequately, deeply entrenched in our societies by their association with vested interests and special interests of various kinds. And we don't have the political institutions, either nationally or globally, that would allow us to overcome the intractable collective action problems that are associated with climate change. It's no wonder we're not making any progress on the problem.
So you see then IPCC, the UNFCCC, is inadequate institutions for dealing with the problem as it is. Do you see other institutions that should replace them, or should they be fundamentally changed, or what do you think is the right way forward at this point?
The UNFCCC process and the IPCC scientific process are both fundamentally inadequate. And I think we saw the consequences of that in Copenhagen. We've seen the consequences of the IPCC inadequacy with all the brouhaha surrounding the East Anglia affair and the incessant attacks by vested interest-backed climate skeptics against the scientific case for climate change. And both the UNFCCC process and the IPCC process emerge from a very conventional management understanding of how we should deal with our society's problems, one that's based in risk analysis, one that assumes we can break these problems apart and understand them in their micro characteristics and then put everything back together and manage the overall system, one that assumes a certain rational, bureaucratic, deliberate political process of coping with our challenges, one that more or less assumes that whatever happens will be incremental and that we can cope with incrementalist responses, bureaucratic, scientific, technological responses. I think all of these premises just don't hold. And so we do need something fundamentally different. What it's going to look like, it's very hard to say right now. I've written recently in the New York Times suggesting that we can expect that very little is going to happen given the accumulation of vested interests, special interests blocking change. Very little is going to happen in the absence of some kind of climate shock or climate crisis. And this goes back to my original argument in The Upside of Down, that it's at those moments of crisis where you have opportunities for punctuated change, when you have opportunities for making major steps forward. If you think in advance about what you're going to do at those moments of crisis. If you just wait until the crisis occurs, then it's very likely you won't be able to take advantage of the opportunity. So my request, in a sense, my argument in the New York Times article was that we should be thinking now about what we're going to do in these moments of crisis. I called for a concerted national and international Plan Z, or in American terms, Plan Z, which means a plan for what we are going to do if things go south on the climate file really fast. If things start to happen in the climate that have major implications for humankind, food shortfalls, for instance. This is one of the scenarios that I put front and center in the article. And then when people are ready to countenance the possibility of really major change in their systems, we should have some options available, already thought out, that we can put onto the table and say, okay, these are the possibilities, these in response to this particular scenario. But that's all advanced work that we need to do. We need to be starting to do it now. In other words, I think we need to do the climate science the process that has been developed in a very elaborate way through the IPCC. We need to have international negotiations. There need to be substantial modifications to the scientific process, I think, to make it more transparent, among other things. The international negotiations are probably going to evolve into a set of bilateral and small group negotiations. I don't expect much progress there in the absence of a climate shock. The real things that we need to be thinking about, though, are what we're going to do when that climate shock happens. What are we going to do in terms of changing national and global approaches, providing new avenues for climate policy, a global carbon regime, national carbon regimes, major new investments in energy transition. How are we going to deal with the welfare implications? How are we going to help those groups globally and within our own societies that are affected most severely by this transition that could be very abrupt? We need to start thinking about that now in detailed ways so that when a crisis occurs, we are ready to respond in detailed ways.
Do you think we'll be able to recognize the crisis when it hits, or is it?
I have no question. I think. Remember, I said climate has this unusual characteristic that it's a crisis that extends over a period of centuries, but it will have these moments, these punctuated moments, that actually will be defined as crisis in human terms, not just in the longer geological time frame. So there will be occasions. Now, I think the big question. I received a very, very robust response to this New York Times article. It went viral very quickly, and I received a huge number of emails. And the big question in people's minds is, will it be too late when the crisis occurs? And I think to a certain extent, we have to just hope we're lucky. We need a crisis that happens soon enough that we can respond adequately with adequate resources, that isn't so large that it debilitates us entirely and we have no capability of responding. The crisis needs to be, however, large enough that it actually mobilizes us politically and discredits the vested interests that are blocking change. It's a key thing. You know, you look at the recent Gulf oil well blowout, the BP disaster, you look at the financial crisis, you look at various other crises. The reason that they create opportunities for change is they provide evidence that discredits the powerful vested interests that are blocking change. The oil companies were telling us that we didn't need to worry about deep sea oil drilling because the risks were minimal, if not non-existent. Prior to the financial crisis, all the people involved in derivatives trading were saying that the risks were minimal and that they understood what was going on and everything could be managed. And that included all people all the way up to the level of Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve in the United States. And it's only after a crisis that those responses are no longer compelling, that those justifications and defensive arguments by vested interests are no longer compelling. Mm-hmm. And it's at those points when people can be mobilized to take advantage of an opportunity to change. But as I said before, you know, we need to be ready to do that. We need to have plans ready to go to offer opportunities for change.
Where should we look for leadership in such a scenario after a crisis, assuming that vested interests are swept aside? Where does that change come from? Is it something organic? Is it in the existing institutions? Is it charismatic leaders? Where should we look?
What we've depended on in the past is charismatic leaders. And, you know, sometimes we've been lucky and sometimes we haven't been. Sometimes people are available in the system and step to the fore. And other times you've had kind of a systemic disintegration or a system is dissolved into a fight among various people who are trying to seize the initiative. Or you have an extremist leader come to the fore who pushes the whole social system or political system in a horrible direction. And you can see, for instance, the contrast during the Great Depression. It was really instructive. In the United States, it was touch and go whether the United States was going to move in essentially a fascist direction. There was a strong possibility that extreme right-wing elements in the United States could capture power. It turned out, though, that there was a remarkably competent leader who was able to bring the country together, Franklin Roosevelt, bring the country together, and fundamentally reform the social system and the capitalist system in a way that laid a foundation for American power for the next half century. In Europe, especially in Germany, something very different happened. You had an extremist leader come to power that provided a set of options and solutions to the people of Germany at the time, and that pushed Europe towards war and ultimately the Holocaust. What we want to try to do is, while we can't control these outcomes precisely, we want to try to increase the probability that we'll go in the positive direction rather than a negative direction. I'm not sure that you can put in place particular leaders in advance, but what you can do and what we can do democratically is develop the social capital and the networks among various progressive groups so that they are that they are prepared and that they have built up a reservoir of trust and understanding among themselves so that they can move effectively. We've seen various occasions where this has happened in the past. The Orange Revolution in the Ukraine, it's unfortunately has degenerated into something less laudable in recent years, but when it occurred, it wasn't a spontaneous event. It was the result of an enormous amount of advanced planning among democratic groups in the Ukraine who had been thinking about how they were going to take advantage of an opportunity for deep democratic reform. And they exploited the crisis when it came along. I think you can see the same going back further in time with the Solidarity movement in Poland. They tried once and it fell apart and the Soviets invaded. But eventually, and they kept working in the background, and they kept meeting in the churches and maintaining their social capital and their networks. And then eventually, when the Soviet Union did start to disintegrate, there was already an apparatus of social mobilization and a set of plans for what they were going to do to lead Poland in a new direction available to them because they'd done a lot of work in advance. I think the same is probably true with the transition away from apartheid in South Africa. We look at events like this and we're amazed by how remarkably peaceful they were. For instance, in South Africa, I traveled with a friend in South Africa in the 1980s, 1983, all over South Africa. This is when Grand Apartheid was still functioning. And the society was deeply divided. And we spoke to every single racial group in the society. And across the board, everybody from regular people all the way up to the highest level of politicians and decision makers in the society said, a change is coming, but it's going to be deeply violent. It's going to rend this society. And yet, what turned out was a remarkably peaceful transition. But that wasn't because of just luck. It wasn't a fluke. It was because people had done a lot of work in advance to make sure that that when the crisis came, that the system was pushed in a positive direction rather than devolving into violence and civil war. So, to answer your question, I don't think we can specify who the leaders are going to be, choose the leaders, and I don't think we should rely fundamentally on charismatic leaders, but we can raise the probability that things will turn out better by developing a lot of the social infrastructure, the networks, the trust, the plans, the resources, financial, organizational resources ahead of time that can allow people to push the system in a positive direction rather than better. The best we can, rather than a negative direction. The best we can hope for ultimately is a shifting of the probabilities in our favor.
I suppose an added complication compared to these other examples we gave is that a climate crisis will be global. So these networks, these institutions, whatever, are would have to be global as opposed to in individual countries where there's maybe more natural cohesion to some extent. One thing that that you've raised, quite a controversial position, a lot of people think, is this of geoengineering. And you feel that we should move forward with, at least on a research level, move forward with geoengineering. Could you explain your position on that, please?
I think this needs to be one component of a crisis response, potentially. I'm hoping that we don't have to do it. Geoengineering involves the intentional manipulation of the climate to try, for instance, to reduce the amount of solar radiation that penetrates the atmosphere and comes in, heats up the atmosphere. You might be able to do that, for instance, by putting particles in the high atmosphere that reflect sunlight back out into space. An easy way of doing it is to inject large quantities of sulfate aerosols, the kind of material that Mount Pinatubo ejected into the atmosphere, the Filipino volcano back in 1991. Very large quantities, and it increases the reflectivity of the high atmosphere, and so cools the planet a bit. There are other ways of doing it. There have been some recent publications on sort of creating customized particles that would migrate to a given level in the stratosphere or a given part of the atmosphere, say, for instance, over the poles. Now, we don't really have an adequate understanding of what the implications of such interventions might be. So we need to do the research to find out. Because in a time of crisis, it's quite likely the public will be demanding some immediate action. The easiest and cheapest thing to do might be some kind of intervention of this form. We need to know what works, if anything, and how to do it, if we can do it adequately, rather than trying to figure it out on the spot. Again, you can say that the worst thing that we should do is wait until the crisis occurs and then try to figure it out on the spot. The more we think about these things in advance, the better off we'll be. And it goes to the point that you raised a moment ago, too, that we have all these diverse groups around the planet. And part of the deal with geoengineering is figuring out how we're going to make this decision together. When I say we, and I have to be clear about this, I mean humankind as a whole. I mean, we as a human species. Well, when it comes to something like a geoengineering decision, there may be 50 or more societies or economies on the planet that would be rich enough to be able to do it in a way that would affect the planet's climate significantly. So who's the we here? And you can imagine some very hairy scenarios where one country, say China, decides to go ahead or the United States, and produces a result that affects other countries really badly, or at least they think that it's been a consequence of the geoengineering. One might not know because the climate system's so complicated that tracing out the causes and effects might be very difficult. But there might be sufficient grounds for a war. If suddenly you can't produce any food, because the climate is shifted and you think it's attributable to some geoengineering intervention by another country on the other side of the planet. You can imagine situations that could get very nasty very fast. So part of the challenge there is not just doing the research on what geoengineering is possible and what its consequences might be, depending on how you do it, but also figuring out how you're going to govern it. Who's going to make the decision? Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to be responsible or liable if things go wrong? And we haven't even begun to think about any of this. This is exactly, though, the kind of thing that I mean when I say we need to get prepared for crisis. Absolutely high probability, almost guaranteed, that when we have a significant climate crisis, geoengineering will move to the top of the political option list very fast. So we need to get ready for that outcome.
You gave a very interesting speech last year in Germany that I recommend our listeners to go listen to on your website. You call it the Great Transformation. I was wondering if you could give us a brief synopsis of some of the points. You have four transitions that you outline there. If you could give us perhaps a quick overview of that, I think it fits in well with what we've talked about here today.
The conference was on climate change and cultural change, and I think it reflects the fact that in Europe people are much further down the road in thinking about the implications of climate for our societies than elsewhere in the world. The question that was being asked fundamentally was whether climate change will deeply transform our societies in their values, in their aspirations, in their norms, in their basic practices and behaviors, whether it will produce cultural transformation. And I was asked to do the keynote speech, and I argued very strongly that the only way we can really ultimately effectively address this problem is through that kind of cultural transformation. And time again, as I've had conversations with people around the world about climate change, and we've talked about the sources of the problem and what needs to be done, I've learned from those conversations that really the challenge we face is one that's deeply grounded in our values, in our aspirations as human beings, in our understandings of who we are, what the good life is, what we want for our children, and some of the deepest understandings we have about our existential reality, where we are, what our relationship with nature is, what the meaning of what brings meaning into our lives. And those things, unfortunately, probably change very slowly. At least in the past, they have. Although we have some advantages now around our world that I think our networked reality allows for social mobilization and social change and even deep cultural change to occur much more quickly than it has in the past. But this is something, again, that we need to think about very carefully, because this kind of value shift, we may be able to work on this substantially before a crisis comes, so that when the crisis comes, we're actually well down the road in preparing ourselves morally and in terms of our values and philosophically for the transition to a new world. So I talked about a number of transitions, cognitive, economic, value transitions that are essential to this overall transformation, cultural transformation. I talked about the need to shift from seeing the world as a machine that can be precisely manipulated to seeing it as a complex system. We've already had a bit of that conversation. I reflected on the distinction between risk and uncertainty and how not just our decision makers and leaders and policymakers, but our everyday members of the public need to have an intuitive understanding of what complexity is and why we're now in a world that's replete with unknown unknowns. And that just needs to be part of the instinct of our average member of our average democratic society. Because without that, there's always going to be this response on the part of members of our societies that that, well, why can't you just fix this problem? It's a machine. Just find the bit that's broken, the part that's broken, and fix it and make this problem go away, the climate problem go away. Once they understand that we're dealing with complex systems, they'll realize that that's such an approach isn't appropriate anymore. That instead we have to accept the limits of our capacity to control the systems around us, including the climate, and we have to tolerate a lot of ambiguity and a lot of uncertainty, and be fundamentally prudent in our responses to the systems around us. So that was one very important transition I remarked on. Another was the need to move from understanding our economies as essentially driven by endless growth to recognizing the importance of evolving towards a steady state economic system. And I discussed the role of economic growth within our current economies and our societies more generally. Why it is that economic growth is sacrosanct. Why nobody is prepared to challenge it. And I mentioned that economic growth is understood, and quite rightly so in many ways, to be providing a lot of benefits. It makes us wealthier. And many of us perceive that as we are wealthier, we are happier. There are probably some reasons why that's not always the case. But there certainly seems to be some prima facie evidence that greater wealth makes people happier, especially up to a level of, say, $20,000 a year per capita income. Growth makes us freer. There are some strong arguments that the societies that maintain economic growth are the ones that are most politically free and socially free. Those arguments have been made most effectively by Benjamin Friedman at Harvard University, an economist at Harvard University. Growth allows us to pay off our debts, so we equate it in our mind with solvency. We grow out of our economic obligations. We make our economies larger, so our debts are a smaller proportion of our overall wealth. And we do this with our pension systems. We do this at the household level. We probably are going to have to do it with our current economic crisis. The only way, ultimately, we can resolve the accumulation of debt we have in this world today is to make the global economy larger so that the debt is a smaller proportion of that economy. And fundamentally, probably the most important association we have in our minds about the benefits of economic growth is that we assume that as economies grow, they remain peaceful. So we equate economic growth with peace. And that's a lesson we learned in the 1930s when we had a collapse in economic growth, a surge in unemployment, and ultimately ended up with a rise of extremist movements in Europe and a global war and the Holocaust. And for all of these reasons, our equation in our minds with growth equaling solvency, growth equaling happiness, growth equaling freedom, growth equaling peace, we don't want to let go of growth. And yet, manifestly, it's now causing a phenomenal crisis. Our growing world economy is running into the limits of the global ecosystem. And the capacity of our global natural systems to absorb the waste that's being produced by our global economy. So one of the fundamental transformations, I argued in this speech, that we have to engage in is a shift in the fundamental basis of our economic systems so that we can have the peace, the solvency, the freedom, and the happiness in the absence of economic growth. And I pointed out that probably fundamental to that transformation is a shift in our understanding of what the good life is, what it is that makes us happy, what brings meaning into our lives. In the absence of a shift in our understanding of the good life, away from materially intensive values to different kinds of value systems, we're probably not going to be able to give up on growth as a source of social stability and happiness.
Okay, one final question. You first rose to international prominence back in the early 1990s around this environmental security discourse, and one of the founders that linked environmental stress with violent conflict. What are your reflections 20 years later on this debate, and is this something you still see as current and as something that's sort of been borne out in the empirics of this theoretical framework you laid out?
My timeline has always been decades into the future, and it gives me an advantage in that it's actually quite difficult to falsify a lot of my arguments, because whether I turn out to be right or wrong is going to be largely determined after at least I'm gone, and perhaps a lot of my interlocutors are gone too. But this research on environmental stress and violent conflict has been around for quite a while now. I did the first of this research back in the late 1980s. And so we have a couple of decades now of empirical evidence to judge whether there's a basis for some of the assertions that I was making all those years ago. Now, you know, I'm not the most disinterested person to ask, but I would say that things are unfolding pretty well as I expected. I anticipated that various kinds of environmental stresses would get worse in poor countries, especially shortages of cropland, deforestation, shortages of water, and then in a variety of ways under some circumstances, and I have to stress both those things, in a variety of ways and under some circumstances, those environmental stresses could lead to social breakdown and violence. But I always argued that it was a multi-causal process, that under certain circumstances, these environmental stresses could encourage societies to pull together and make them less conflictual, depending on the nature of their institutions and their values and their social systems. But under other circumstances, which I tried to specify in a first order way, preliminary way, under other circumstances, these stresses could lead to social breakdown and violence. And one of the things that I said was particularly important was the capability of societies to respond in ingenious ways, in inventive ways, to resource scarcities. Some societies are good at that, and some societies aren't very good. And if they aren't very good, then it's more likely that water shortages and cropland shortages and fuel wood shortages are going to produce ultimately some kind of social disintegration and violence. I think that story has, and the arguments I made have in a sense, acquitted themselves fairly well, that there's no reason to fundamentally reform or change the arguments. In every one of these cases, though, the causation is complex. There are a lot of different factors involved. And environmental factors are only one in that large mixture of things. And the relationships between them are often very opaque. Take a look, for instance, at Pakistan right now. Now, Pakistan's a society that we highlighted right from the beginning of our research. It's one where there's extraordinary environmental stress, where degradation of cropland and deforestation in the countryside was causing movement of huge numbers of people into major cities like Karachi, and in turn destabilizing those cities. Now, recently in Pakistan, we've seen enormous floods and some real questions about the viability of the state as a whole. The possibility now, many people are discussing, of the country disintegrating into regions and perhaps civil war or an extremist takeover of some kind. All of those outcomes we elaborated many years ago, 15 years ago. The role of environmental factors is significant, but again embedded in lots of other things. There's been this deforestation and land degradation, as I mentioned. it's interesting that in the recent commentary on the floods, very few people have mentioned that one of the reasons the floods have been so bad is that the absorption capacity of the hinterland, of the forests, has been reduced substantially because there's been so much deforestation in the country. That siltation of the waterways has, and reservoirs has made them much more vulnerable to being overwhelmed by higher runoff with an extreme monsoon like this. And the siltation is a result of, again, deforestation and bad land management that has allowed a lot of silt to move into those waterways. Few people have commented on just the sheer population pressures in Pakistan, that this is a country that has done one of the worst jobs in family planning in the world. And the population pressure in itself has made managing economic development, managing the land, managing the forests effectively far more difficult. Now, population, deforestation, land management, the salinization of the agricultural land, all of these factors are part of the mix, and a mix that includes things like corruption, institutional failure, the role of the military, a political system that's completely dysfunctional. So what happens in the standard analysis that you see in newspapers is that people focus on the variables that they're most comfortable with. And usually for commentators, that's the political and social stuff. And the environmental stuff gets left in the background. Although if you want to do a full analysis of Pakistan, those factors are ferociously powerful underneath the surface as driving the society towards a precipice, constraining the possible outcomes in ways that make things going badly much more likely than things going well. One of the reasons that I ended up being much more interested in complex systems and sensitive to the implications of complex systems is that I realized when I was doing this work on environment and conflict many years ago that I could not understand, even begin to understand, the interplay of all of these factors without taking complexity seriously. And I guess one of my larger efforts with the general public is to translate some of that lesson into an understanding for the general public, because just about all the problems we face right now have the same kind of multi-causal, non-linear, entangled characteristic as the ones I was studying decades ago and that are still unfolding around us right now, the links between environmental change and violence.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Thomas Homer Dixon.
Thank you.
And that was Thomas Homer Dixon, professor from the University of Waterloo in Canada, distinguished scholar on environment, on security. Environmental security was his original field of study, which attracted quite a bit of attention back in the early 1990s and forward. And most recently, The Upside of Down, his book from 2006, and also a lot of civilization and environmental issues that he is a leading thinker on. And we're very happy to have him on tonight's episode of Think Globally Radio. So thanks to Professor Thomas Homer Dixon. Next Sunday, we'll be talking to Owen Gaffney from the International Geosphere Biosphere Program. He'll be here in the studio to discuss some other big picture issues. And every Sunday evening at 7 o'clock, Think Globally Radio here on THS. Also on the web at www.thinkgloballyradio.org. And be sure to join our group on Facebook. Eric Paglia signing off and leaving things over to Spectrum.